Today's show is brought to you by School Spirit Vending. School Spirit Vending has a hassle-free, year-round fundraising program for schools. You can learn more at schoolspiritvending.com.
Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where school leaders go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top influencers in education. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Daniel Bauer.
In today's show, I'm joined by Morgan Wright, a cybersecurity expert that I met online through the View from the Top community I'm a part of. You're going to enjoy this show a lot. He's going to talk about how to always be inquisitive, the keys to quickly reading people, how to create better passwords, and how to live a more secure and safe life. I never take it for granted that you're listening. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Actually, in Shauna, it's Tino Tenda, and enjoy the show. Well, hey, Better Leaders, I am excited to bring to you today a friend, Morgan Wright. He's somebody I connected with online through a really fun place called The Community, which my buddy Aaron Walker, he leads that over at viewfromthetop.com. And Morgan is an internationally recognized expert on cybersecurity strategy, cyber terrorism, identity theft, and privacy. His landmark testimony before Congress on healthcare.gov changed how the government collected personally identifiable information. He has made hundreds of appearances on national news, radio, print, and web, and has spoken to audiences around the world. Previously, Morgan was a senior advisor in the U.S. State Department Anti-Terrorism Assistance Program and senior law enforcement advisor for the 2012 Republican National Convention. In addition to 18 years in state and local law enforcement, Morgan has developed solutions in defense, justice, and intelligence for the largest technology companies in the world. Morgan, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Principal Bauer, thank you.
Appreciate that. So, Morgan, let's start with your leadership style. How would you describe it, and how did you develop this style?
That is an interesting question. You know, part of this was born out of, I was a military brat growing up, so it was always around the military, command and control, making sure that you always had a good presence when you showed up somewhere, shoe shine, you know, having everything in order. And that kind of carried me through. You know, I fell away from it a little bit in high school, college. I joined the reserves, ROTC, went back through basic training, got that back again, went into law enforcement. And so it's always been very much a, you know, I love doing what I do. But I think the kind of best way to describe the leadership style is don't mistake my kindness for weakness. I love what I do, more than happy to help. But then there's also a point to where I believe in the mission. I believe in things, obviously defending our country, defending my community. And so there are certain lines I don't cross. You know, I'm more than happy to engage in discussion. But you reach a point, though, too, to where it's kind of everybody has to know you're dead serious about what you're dead serious about. And I think part of the leadership style is it's that always being inquisitive, always being questioning, always wanting to learn, being a good student as well. But at some point, you are the keeper of the purpose. You are responsible for making decisions and carrying those things out. And you have to do it with conviction and with purpose, to where people know, and they just know from your authenticity that you believe in what you do, you believe in the decisions you made, you believe in carrying them out, and you will get people that will follow you in doing that, people who hesitate, people who are less than authentic about their beliefs and what they do, I think really have a tough time leading people. And I just love watching some of these congressional hearings that are going on. I know this is going to be out about a month after the hearings and the inauguration. But watching some folks like General Mattis, you know, in the Marines, my daughter's boyfriend served under him in Afghanistan. You know, you see some people that really display some very good leadership traits. And so that's kind of, you know, Daniel, kind of rounded out. It's kind of that way. I love what I do. Always want to keep doing it. But at the same time, once you're around me long enough, you know, I'm real serious about what I do. I love what I do. But this is something I hope to carry with me.
You know, it seems like a fine line, Morgan. So I'm wondering if you could speak to that a little bit in terms of being a leader that's compassionate and cares about the people while still being taken as serious, right? And not being taken advantage of or having your kindness mistaken for weakness. One thing I'm learning as a young leader, I think my default too often is to trust people. And it's, that sounds weird saying it out loud, but I'm still trying to figure it out. But I think, you know, I know that I trust people way too much right off the bat. And I don't know the answer, so I'm kind of just talking out, you know, out loud here.
Sure.
But I'm curious, like, how have you figured out that balance between the kindness, the compassion, and then still the seriousness, the accountability, and that type of thing.
I think one of the things I learned early on, and actually I ended up instructing this, was behavior analysis and behavior analysis interviewing, interrogation. I taught out at the National Security Agency to a damage assessment agents who worked the Aldrich James, Earl Edwin Pitts, James Harold Nicholson spy cases. And one of the things I learned from my time in law enforcement as a detective was to quickly read people, and not so much to say, well, I put you in a box, but it's more to say, you need to really start understanding why people are motivated. And the issue of trust, it's funny you should mention that, because in law enforcement, it's a very small circle. You trust very few people outside your circle, but you learn to deal with them. And, you know, for you, Daniel, it'd be like things in graduating that kind of trust. It's like, there is a basic level of trust, but look, just because you walk in the door and say, hey, I'd like to have the keys to your car, doesn't mean you're going to get them. We haven't got to that point yet. I don't know you. You don't get the keys to my car. You know, that would be, if you trusted everybody, you would just do that. But we don't. It's not like it was 30, 40 years ago. Growing up as a kid, you go out on your bicycle, you know, you're fine. Be gone all day during the summer, come back at night, everything was okay. So I think what we've done with you, and especially with you, is you almost have to look at things as like there are levels of trust, and a basic level of trust, if I don't know you and you don't know me, there's only so many things I'm going to allow you to do. And it's not because I don't trust you, it's because I don't know you. And until I know you and I know what your motivations are, then we start graduating up that ladder of trust. And once you get to a point, when I've worked with you or I know you or I've seen you in situations, I know that you won't compromise your ethics, you won't compromise me, then you get more about the trust. It's like having conversations. You meet somebody for the first time, unless you're really an open kind of person, you plan on telling everybody everything. We kind of wait till we hold people at arm's length till we get a sense, a feel for it. So some of this is emotional, but some of it is just simply, you know, I ask some clarifying questions sometimes. I try and find out, why do you ask those things? One of my favorite responses, people say, well, what do you think about this? My favorite question is, why do you ask? You know, to find out why, you know, what their motivation is sometimes. And it's not being paranoid, but I think in this world, I run into so many people with what I do. I have to be guarded, but you do it in a way that doesn't appear that you're being guarded. It's like you're being open. You ask some questions, you respond to things. Sometimes I deflect questions and I don't answer them directly because I don't want to put that person in an awkward position. But for you, Daniel, especially with the kind of work that you do, you almost have to be in that where you do trust people, or you do want to be open enough to where people approach you. And the thing is, it's not so much that you trust them as can they believe that they can trust you by your actions, by the way you've acted before. Then you'll get people being authentic with you. It's when they don't trust you, you end up not trusting them as well. So I think, you know, your default may be to trust too much, but I think you could always do it by keeping it in perspective to say, I trust you, but to a point. I trust you now to this next level. Now I trust you to this next level as you get to know them. And sometimes, Daniel, it's an element of proof. You know, have we done enough stuff to where I feel confident that, you know, that if we were in a jury trial, I could convict you of being my friend? Well, if that's the case, then I'm certainly going to trust you with a lot more information and things between us than I would just a stranger off the street. So it's kind of a long way of saying there's really no good answer to that. But over time, you develop your own way of assessing people, listening to how they talk, looking at their body language, seeing is it congruent with their actions and words? Are they congruent together? And then, you know, you ask a couple questions and then you start making your own determinations. Everybody will have a different style. And I know you, Daniel, I mean, you're always a kind guy. You're outgoing. And can that be a detriment sometimes? Sure. Can it be an absolute asset other times? Absolutely. So I think what may hurt you at some points really helps you at other times.
Yeah, and what I hear you saying too, you know, taking time to clarify what those different levels, those circles of trust are for me and whatever those milestones and markers will be so that people enter into those different levels of trust.
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of like, especially like in law enforcement, I was doing work in Colombia. You go down, there were some people that you've never met before. I was doing some work with some folks in the government. But there is an implicit level of trust because we both have been through, let's say, the same background, and we both have security clearances, and we both work doing the same type of work. So you do go into it with a certain level of trust. But even then, even though the government trusts you, Daniel, there's kind of an old joke, you know, about, you know, trust but verify. Well, that's the case, is I trust you, but you don't, just because I trust you doesn't mean you get access to this kind of information. It's not your responsibility, or it may be too much for you to handle at this point. So I just simply say it's not just an issue of trust. It's just an issue of, it's like talking with kids and stuff. I don't think you're ready to handle this kind of information yet, or it's not appropriate that I share it with you. It has nothing to do with you. It's more about me. But, you know, dealing with people is one of the hardest things, and trying to find, strike the right balance. I think we spend way too much time trying to figure out, are we striking the right balance, as opposed to just be yourself, be authentic, treat everybody nice, and then let them be the ones to put themselves in a different category of not being able to be trusted, or they're not a good person. I'm like you. I like to go in and say, look, I believe everybody's kind, until you clearly show otherwise.
And so one of those clarifying questions, if I remember correctly, was like, why do you ask? Do you have other types of go-to clarifying questions that you use?
You know, it kind of depends. Like when you're in your situation where you might be dealing with students, you know, in their teens and stuff, a lot of times, give you an example. When my daughter got yours, mine, and ours, but our youngest, when she was in high school or even in junior high, she'd come down to me and say, Dad, I brushed my teeth. And I'd look at her and say, are you sure? And then I just look for the response.
Right.
And then she'd go back and I'd say, she goes, then I'd ask her next time, next night, honey, did you brush your teeth? She goes, yes. I said, are you sure? She goes, yes. I say, if I go upstairs right now, will your toothbrush be wet? And then you just look for the response and then go back up. You know, and then it works all the way through to where one time I said, did you use toothpaste? Yes, Dad, I used toothpaste. And then I pulled the toothpaste out from behind my back, said, be a little tough since I've been holding on to it for the last half hour. So you finally get to the point of where they realize, you know, it's kind of been a standing joke between us. But sometimes you have to ask those questions. It's not because I don't trust you. It's because I don't understand what your motivations are. And I just want to make sure from a communication standpoint that I'm actually answering the original question or the intent of the question, or the somebody might say, hey, do you know what's going on? Why do you ask? Oh, because my mom's outside, you know, and I have to find out for that. Oh, as opposed to, oh, well, I just heard, and, you know, we're just kind of, you know, in a sense, they're being nosy. You're going to have to judge it for yourself. So I mean, I ask things like that, you know, why do you ask? Quite frankly, it's not so much the question you ask, Daniel. I'm going to give you a little trick here. When I used to do interview and interrogation, it wasn't the question. It was the response before, during, or after the question. For example, if I said, Daniel, you know, did you rob that bank? Excuse me, what, me? Did I rob that bank? It's not the answer. It's you cleared your throat, or you delayed. It's a delaying tactic. Or you mean rob that bank? No, I never robbed that bank. You know, and so there were so many questions the way you could ask things. But I think it's just, I think sometimes the direct approach is best. I just simply say, why do you ask? You know, can you tell me why this is important that, you know, I answer it this time? Is there anything else that I should know about this question before I answer it? Or, you know, where, you know, you kind of get into the motivation. It's hard to say, here's the questions you ask, because every situation is going to be a little bit different. But I tell you one thing more than asking the question, Daniel, is reading the body language. I think body language is much more effective and much more accurate at reading people's true intentions than actual words are. And that's been proven through study after study, to where nonverbal communication is more accurate than verbal. So I combine the both. I ask the question. But what I focus more on is looking at the response of the body. Is it open? Is it genuine? Or do they appear to be that they're hiding something, you know, deflecting away from it, not looking me in the eye? That's not always an indicator, but that sometimes, do they look away during a critical point of the conversation? And you've seen that stuff too. So actually, if we had time or sometime, I'd actually pull out, I have a whole manual on the way to ask questions. You know, who do you think did it? Why do you think? What do you think should happen to this person? That was one of my favorite questions, when you found somebody doing something. They say, well, it wasn't me. Well, okay, it wasn't you. But what do you think ought to happen to the person who, in fact, did throw the baseball through the window? Well, I think they ought to just be allowed to apologize, you know, and fix the window. Oh, I get it, you know.
You did it.
Yeah. No, but, you know, that's the team. Yeah. Everybody has a tough time passing judgment on themselves. Imagine being a 10-year-old, you just threw a baseball through a window, and your parents say, well, you know, Daniel, what do you think we ought to do to you? Well, I think I ought to get a spanking and be sent to bed without supper. No kid's going to volunteer that.
Right.
They're going to, you know, they're going to say, well, what do you think we ought to do to the person who did break the window? Give them a second chance, maybe, you know.
Well, that's good stuff. You know, I'm glad it took a little turn there to get to the keys of reading people quickly. And I think the listeners will definitely enjoy the last few minutes there. Maybe we can get to the manual at some point someday. But, you know, appreciate you being on the show, Morgan. You know, we're talking about leadership and how you've developed your leadership over the years. I'm curious, what do you consider your worst leadership mistake, and what did you learn from it?
Probably my worst leadership mistake, probably when I took over as an executive at a technology company, I didn't get rid of somebody fast enough. And I say that in all sincerity. It's not, I don't like people who just casually toy with people's occupation, you know, and their livelihood. But when there's a cancer inside a team, when there's a problem inside the team, and it's been passed on and on and on, and then it's kind of put into your lap, I let it go for a little bit too long, thinking, hey, look, I'm the new guy here. I'm going to make, you know, I'm going to try and let's start over again. But clearly there was documentation, there was stuff, and I probably let it go on for about 60 days too long. It's nothing that it wasn't recoverable, but I look at it, I did a disservice to the person that I had to let go, and I did a disservice to the rest of the team. Because like you, I was trying to be nice because I was the new guy, you know, taking over a rather large team. We were doing a lot of work in public safety with a new technology where just our market alone was worth probably $1.7 to $2 billion. And so, I mean, you know, you really got to have people who can step up and do that type of work. And I think one of the things was I wasn't decisive as I should have been because I erred on the side of let me give them a I know all the documentation's there. I know all the writing's there. But hey, look, you know, I'm going to try and work this through because I wanted to give everybody a chance coming in. And quite frankly, what I should have done is stuck with my guns and realized this isn't a good fit for them. I'm doing them a disservice if I don't give them a chance to find something that's more in line with their abilities. And their desires. They may have wanted to do this job, but they didn't have the skill set to do it. And it's at a certain level, you know, Daniel, you run into, it's like at a certain level, you are expected to have those kind of skills. You're expected to have that kind of knowledge because that's up to you. That's part of your journey. And you're expected to have those things. I think Steve Jobs said it once. He says, look, the problem is there's some people who are not used to being held to such a high standard. And I think that was part of the question. We didn't hold people to a high enough standard. And we let the cancer spread for a while, but got it fixed. Took a while. It took a lot of work with HR. But that's probably one of the things, you know, I would say in the recent memory that I wish I would have done different.
Morgan, tell me the story of starting Identity Predators.
So a lot of the work that I did when I was a mere state trooper, I actually was lazy. There's actually this all ties together. And I used to do a lot of big accident reconstruction formulas, a lot of math involved, intensive mechanical engineering, crush formulas, energy formulas. So in the old days, every time you changed a variable, you had to go back through and take out a calculator. Believe it or not, I even used a slide rule at one time and recalculate things. I said, man, there's got to be an easier way. So taught myself how to write programs in BASIC, wrote a program in BASIC. And so I started getting fascinated with technology, did a lot of work in the technology space, was one of the first people to go through computer crime training back in 1993, ended up teaching the FBI for a year on how to do internet investigations. So a lot of people would say, well, gee, you know, because one of my degrees is in computer information systems, say, well, you know, you're a techie guy. No, not really. One of the things I came to realize is that we actually live in multiple worlds here. We just don't live in the technology world. There are three worlds we actually live in. Now, we live in an online world, you know, everything that's available through the internet, through the World Wide Web. We live in the offline world, like what we do around the house or around our business. And then we are out in the real world. Once we get outside our secure zones or our places of work, you know, where you live, work, and play, once you're out into the real world, then there's other things that happen. And I realized that there were bad people out there doing all sorts of things. People, bad people online, bad people offline, bad people in the real world. And what we were doing is only training people to recognize threats in one area. It's kind of like teaching people how to drive and say, only worry about people running a stop sign. Don't worry about people running a yield sign, or don't worry about people turning in front of you. Well, no, that's not the real world. The real world is you've got people out there trying to figure out how to separate you from your money, from your identity, from your personally identifiable information, your protected health information. So I started looking. I said, look, what's missing? And I haven't seen a book on this that really addresses it from all three. And this is where I think my skills really helped me between being in investigations, teaching computer crime, teaching behavior analysis, serial crime profiling, you know, having worked in the intelligence community. I looked, I said, what's really needed is kind of how do we approach this to where we give people all the tools they need? We teach them how to drive. You know, the yellow line does not keep that car on the other side of the road. So how do we teach people to really defend and understand the threats that are out there, how to identify them, how to defend against them, how to deflect, and how to level up their defenses? So that's where I came up with Identity Predators. Somebody said, well, why don't you call it Digital Predators? That sounds pretty good. Well, digital makes it sound like it's online, and it's not. So criminals are very good about exploiting the gaps between the three worlds, online, offline, and real world. And that's why I wrote this book, is to say, one, like you get from the, for example, give you two quick examples of hybrid threats. That one starts online and goes offline, for example, you get the Microsoft. Everybody's probably heard of the Microsoft scam that comes in where they call you on the phone. So that starts as offline, starts as your home on a phone. And they says, but we need to get you on your computer. We're seeing some security incidents. So you give remote control of your computer. They install malware. Then they charge you to remove the malware. So that's a case where in offline, a phone call comes in, brings you online. There's another case, too, where offline, like a phone like the IRS scam, then takes you out into the real world. So they start with you on the phone. They convince you that you owe the government money. Then they send you off to get a MoneyGram or a MoneyPack. and send the money. And look, they get hundreds of millions of dollars a year doing this. So we were trained to do one thing, but not another. So that's kind of how I came up with identity predators, is they're trying to separate you from the things, your most valuable things, the things that identify you as a person, your information, you know, obviously your finances, your family and their information, your bank account, things like that. So that's why I wrote it, to bring it all together in one place.
And listeners, you know, you can pick that up at identitypredators.com.
Yeah, actually, it'll be launching here pretty soon, and everybody who signs up. But one of the things I decided to do is I'm going to give the book away for free. It's just, you're just going to have to pay for shipping. It's something I believe in, and it's something I think everybody, especially in your audience too, they need to take into account, because these threats are changing. The things that you and I faced growing up, or you and I faced in school, weren't there. Where now we're looking at apps that have a lot of implications, like Yik Yak and Snapchat. We're looking at sexual predators who use technology. We're looking at how to notifications in case of emergency, how we use the technology. How do we protect our information? So there's a lot around this that I thought, there's a lot of lessons in that book. While it wasn't written exactly for schools, you know, for principals, there's a lot of lessons you can take and say, oh man, I get that. I understand that. It can apply to many, many situations.
Today's show is brought to you by School Spirit Vending. School Spirit Vending has a hassle-free, year-round fundraising program for schools, and the best part is that it's absolutely free. With School Spirit Vending, we do all the work, you just cash a check. You can increase school spirit with custom stickers for your school and raise funds at the same time, no upfront costs, no volunteers, no selling. Sick of the same old ways of raising money for your school? Check out schoolspiritvending.com. You know, another thing that we've talked about offline is just the passwords, right? And having one that works, that's secure, is going to keep you safe and protect your information. You got a resource for our listeners there. Do you mind explaining that a little bit?
Sure. They can go to my other site. It's called identitysecurity.com/password, PASSWORD, identitysecurity.com/password. You know, Daniel, one of the things I learned is that people, and you have to learn it, how this gets into some education. How do people learn? How do even adults learn? Or what's the best way people learn? Trying to memorize random things is more difficult than using mnemonics, memory tricks, memory phrases. For example, I still to this day can tell you the eight types of shock. When I was a state trooper and I became an EMT, we had to learn the eight types of shock, and it was based on a mnemonic called CHAMPS, RN, CHAMPSRN, cardiogenic, hemorrhagic, anaphylactic, metabolic, septic, psychogenic, septic, renal, and neural. And I mean, oh, how can you remember that after the day? Well, I didn't learn. What I learned was CHAMPS, RN. It was easy to remember that. It gave me a memory starter. So what I thought, and this is really how it got me thinking about this, is that I can teach you and show you how easy it is to have a separate password for everything you do. And I'll teach it to you in just 15 seconds, real quickly here right now, Daniel. So let me ask you, what's your favorite food? Say pizza.
Oh, it is pizza. I'm from Chicago. That's easy.
Of course, man. Pizza. All right. So my favorite food is pizza. There are five words in that. And let's say you want to log into Facebook. So an easy passphrase to create for Facebook would be the pound sign, which is you always have a special character, the number five, which is that's the number of words in your passphrase. Then it's just uppercase, lowercase, the first two letters of every word, MYFAFOISPI. So my favorite food is pizza. So uppercase, lowercase. And then when you're logging into Facebook, it's FA. When you're logging into Twitter, it's TW. When you're logging into LinkedIn, it's LI. When you're logging into Citibank, it's CI. So you have a passphrase that is different for every single site that you log into. And I've actually tested this against all these other password managers, LastPass, Dashlane, folks like that. You still have to have a strong password to protect that. Then by the time you get through doing your clicks that you need to do to fill out stuff, I can actually type my password in just as fast. It, from a cryptographic standpoint, it's secure. It scores 100% or more, or 100% on passwordmeter.com, so it checks it against a whole range of things. And look, if your password gets compromised at one place, it does not get compromised at another. And I will tell you right now, there are people listening to this that when I tell them this, they will silently shake their head and say, that's me. There are some people who use the same password for multiple things, including stuff they do at school, including stuff they do at home. And every time you reuse a password, it diminishes its effectiveness by 50%.
Wow.
So that's why Mark Zuckerberg got owned. His LinkedIn account got hacked 4 years ago with the big LinkedIn data breach.
Yeah.
Well, his password was DADADA. Guess what? It was used 4 years later to compromise additional accounts too. because he never changed his password. The election that just went on, John Podesta, one of the reasons that his information got out there, his email got out there, is three factors. Number one is he replied to a spear phishing email, which he never should have done. He should have independently gone to the site if he's going to reset his password. Number two, he wasn't using two-factor authentication, which you folks out there, if your school has it, or if you use Gmail or anything like that, and it has two-factor authentication, which is a third layer of protection, make sure you use it. And the other thing is his password was password. In 2015 and 2016, yeah, it was. Yeah, the most popular password it was 123456.
That's why mine's 123456 7.
Seven. Oh, you see, and then see now. If you go make it, put an 8 in there, it'll become very difficult.
Exactly. So we'll have both those resources in terms of identity predators and creating better passwords linked up for our listeners. You can just click on the links, y'all, and get to those great resources. Hey, Morgan, if we can add a class that isn't currently taught that you know of, what should we add to our schools?
You know, that's interesting because I had somebody else ask me to this. I know they kind of teach things like how to be safe online, you know, how to. But I tell you the thing I don't see, and it's skills for life that teach you. Do we teach kids how to protect their personally identifiable information? In other words, do you know that there are five questions? When somebody asks you for your Social Security number, there are five questions I always ask. Why do you need it? What are you going to do for it? What are you going to do with it? What is the state or federal law that requires me to provide it to you? What happens if I say no? And how do you protect my information? And you wouldn't believe the blank stares I get most of the time. In fact, there is a federal law and a ruling that comes out of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice that says even schools, you can't ask for the Social Security number of a student. I mean, there are laws that prohibit that. Do we teach our kids how to say no online or how to say no to the release of personally identifiable information? Kids, in fact, identity theft is such a huge problem. It's been the top problem 15 out of the last 16 years, number one complaint to the FTC. Number one fastest growing segment of that is identity theft of children. They have identities that have been stolen, used a lot of times by parents and other stuff. So I think, you know, teaching kids real world skills about why is your identity so important? Why is this? Why do you not put your birth date on Facebook, you know, in all these other places? Why? Because I now have your name. I can figure out when you graduated high school, or I know that you're in high school and you're going to graduate a certain year. Now I know your date of birth. Guess what? You've just given me two of the three elements I need, you know, in the clear to commit identity theft. Mm. So I think, you know, really getting beyond this, well, you know, teaching them how to set passwords, teaching them how to use two-factor authentication, teaching them how to protect their information the same way we teach them to drive. We spend more time teaching people to drive than we do teaching them to use the tools that also carry them throughout their life, which is the use of technology, the use of mobile devices, things like that. I mean, we try and scare them straight, you know, sometimes, well, don't use it because bad things happen, as opposed to when you don't use this kind of privacy setting, here's what you do to your friends. Here's what you do to, you know, to yourself. It's millennials are a tougher crowd. They're less concerned about privacy, but they are more concerned about things like their credit cards, you know, or exposing their friends to stuff. So I'd like to see a little bit more around really teaching them the real world skills about how information is stolen, how it's used against them. And what are, you know, do we teach kids in school? I'm sure we do, but it kind of gets lost on them. You know why people fall for the IRS scam, Daniel? Because there are still people in the United States who think they get that phone call and they believe that the IRS can throw you in jail for failing to pay your personal income tax. We've never been a debtor nation, not since before the revolution. But we still have people who believe that they can come in without due process, lock you up, throw away the key, and unless you pay them money right now.
Yeah, they're just playing on people's fears.
Absolutely.
And their ignorance, too, I guess, in this case. So.
But you know, but we've all been taught in school, right? We've all been taught about the Constitution, or we go through history.
Yeah.
But do we really teach people about the way things really work in the real world? Like the IRS does not call you. They send you nasty little letters in white envelopes, you know, with your name in there that says, you know, from the IRS, and you get one of these computer printed sheets. Now, I mean, it's almost like stuff like that. We could prevent so much identity theft, identity fraud, credit card fraud, things like that, if we just taught. For example, I'll give you another trick. I bet you if you reach into your pocket right now and you pull out your wallet with your driver's license is facing forward so I can see your picture or your name on it.
Right.
And, okay, why? You know, here's a little trick, and here's something I do. I always flip my driver's license around backwards. I never know when somebody might be looking, but if they do, all they see is the back of my driver's license. Even little things like that to keep people from picking up on a name. If I get your name, Daniel, if we're in public and we're traveling and I can look down and see your baggage tag or see your name, I start creating a sense of familiarity, you wouldn't believe the things I can do if all I can do is get your name.
Yeah.
And it goes from there.
Just a little glance in the wall and there you go.
Yeah. So just all of these little things, the little skills they don't teach you in school, they should be taught in school.
Hey, Morgan, how do you avoid distractions and stay focused?
What?
How do you...
That was a joke.
Oh, okay.
No, I'll tell you, hey, look, growing up, I dealt with a lot of undiagnosed at that time, but, you know, ADD, and I still deal with shiny object syndrome. I just kind of had to, I use a couple systems. One of the things I learned a couple years ago was Darren Hardy, Best Year Ever. And so I do part of that program, and Insane Productivity was every day. And actually, I have sheets going back, if I showed you a picture, but I have a manila folder, one of these big file folders, probably about 2 inches thick. And what I've been doing every day, 5 days a week, work days for the last year and a half, is every morning when I get up kind of early around, 5:30, 5:45. I'm down here by then. Every day what I do is I do my daily planning. I always write down what are my 3 goals for the year, because I write those down every single day. What skill do I need to develop to achieve that goal? And what do I need to provide? So in other words, like I have a financial goal that says, well, to reach that financial goal, I have to practice focus. And then, but I also have to deliver value. I want to write a bestseller. Well, to write a bestseller, I have to have consistency. So consistency of work, consistency of output. But for that, I have to deliver impact. You know, same thing. So, but then I write those down, and then I write down my 3 big goals every day. And then I use a tool called NOSBE, N-O-Z-B-E.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And that really ties in well with David Allen's Getting Things Done, GTD. And you might hear that as a productivity thing. So I've used that to put constraints on me to where I can stay focused on things. And then I use the Pomodoro technique. So I work for 25 minutes on, focus, 5 minutes off, 25 on, 5 off. Then after about 4 to 5 cycles, I take a little bit longer break. But I find I can stay focused like that. Everybody's going to work a little different, and that's okay. But I just, one of the things I realized, though, too, to stay productive, and I had to learn the hard way, don't multitask, period. Human mind is not designed to do 2 things at once.
No, I can't lose
productivity. Yeah.
I could barely sit in the chair and hold this interview. So it's almost too much for me.
Sorry. I didn't mean to bore you that bad, but maybe we can spice things up.
No, it's all good. Morgan, what's one book every principal should read right now and why?
I'll tell you what. I just got it by Tim Ferriss. It's called, he did interviews with, I think it's 400 people, but it's called Tools of Titans. And the subtitle is The Tactics, Routines, and Habits of Billionaires, Icons, and World-Class Performers. And there is everything in there from health, you know, and fitness, to productivity, to business, to how you think differently. And this is a book that's more than just for business people. I mean, anybody, if you're looking to be innovative, if you're looking to be disruptive, you can't do those things unless you take care of yourself, take care of your body. So you take care of that. You focus on how do we do things differently? How do we create a different impact? And there's these people who are doing extraordinary things just by themselves. Can one person change, create a movement? Absolutely. It's the passion that they do it with. So I would recommend Tools of Titans by Tim Ferriss, 400 interviews of some of the just most amazing minds in the world.
Yeah, that one's in my list, so definitely picking that one up. Morgan, what do you do for fun?
I'm a musician at heart. I went to school on a music scholarship, so I play guitar. I have a banjo in my office here. I also have a 2000 Camaro Super Sport, so I love to get out in that. But I also love to I do a lot of road cycling. So I was training for an Ironman, and I crashed, unfortunately, and broke a rib. But I can bike the full distance. I can swim the full distance without a problem. I just don't run very good, so I can't run the full distance yet. But I love getting out on my bike. I'm in beautiful Northern Virginia, and the trails out here and the mountains out here are just gorgeous. So I love getting out on the bike every chance I get. Even if it's cold, I have the Snowflake Award. I've been out when it's been minus 20.
Wow. Favorite toy when you were 12, what was it?
Oh, my goodness. Probably had to be, man, you're stretching. That's quite a while ago. Favorite toy, probably was something. That's at 12. You know, I don't know, but I do know that growing up, I grew up in a foreign country in Iran. My dad was in the military, so I did grow up with a lot of G.I. Joes.
Okay.
And a lot of things probably related to Star Trek. It probably came out, Star Trek came out just a little bit before I would have been 12.
So Tools of Titans, you mentioned that book. I listened to Tim Ferriss' podcast too, and I sort of adapted one of his questions that he talks about billboards, and I created this question, which is, what message would you put on all school marquees around our nation if you could for a day? What would it say?
I have it written on my wall right here. Adversity is the preparation for greatness.
Adversity is the preparation for greatness. Well, I'll tell you what, you have done a spectacular job on this show. And this is the last question. You're building a school from the ground up. You're not limited by budget or resources. Your only limitation is your imagination. How would you build your dream school, and what would be your top three priorities?
You know, I would. My dream school would be one to where you walk in, it's an immersive experience. I mean, I think one of the things, and I heard this said one time, is that, and it's not a knock, but it's something I heard, but I do believe it's happened. I think they say kids enter schools as question marks and they leave as periods. And I'd love to see people never lose that sense of inquisition, you know, inquisitiveness, I should say, that sense of exploration. I mean, think about the people who went to the moon. Think about, you know, John Glenn just passed away. Think about all these people who challenged things. So I'd love to see a school that was built where it wasn't a focused on the technology, but the technology helped them create the experiences that they could think differently, that they would be challenged to come up, you know, a lot of problem solving, critical thinking. I don't know. I mean, I haven't really thought about that, but I'm actually getting ready to do a webinar with the Austin. I'm a senior fellow at the Center for Digital Government. The Austin Public Library just installed new video and other types of audio technology to create that experience. And so I see a lot more of that. And so, you know, some three things I would do, I'll tell you, I would teach. I think one of the things we definitely need to get back to is teach respect for authority. And that doesn't mean you don't question authority, but I think we've got to get back to teaching respect for authority. That means respect for the teachers in the classroom. Look, I was a cop. I can tell you, not only do I know we had it tough, I know teachers had it tough. And some of the teachers in these places where they worry about their own safety in classes, that's just not acceptable. So I think we have to provide a safe environment. I think we have to get back to teaching respect for authority. I think history is so important. I don't want us to ever lose sight. It doesn't matter that we've made mistakes in our history. That's what makes us who we are. To whitewash those things over robs children of the ability to see of why nations have become great and why they failed. If we remove all the warts, people see through the veneer anyway. So let's tell the story just like it was, just exactly like it was, a good sense of history. And I'll tell you, the other thing is, I would make sure is that we focus a lot more on what they call the STEM technology, but especially science and math. We are losing the battle in those areas, and science and math have been so important to the advancement of our civilization. And we wouldn't have made it to outer space without science and math. We wouldn't have had the breakthroughs in medicine without science and math. You and I would not be talking over Skype tonight, over the internet, without science and math. So I think we've got to get back to, you know, those things. I think, you know, the respect, definitely history and science and technology. Sounds like an odd combination, but hey, you asked me that. That's my thoughts. As Dennis Miller says, I could be wrong.
That's right. Morgan, thank you so much for being a part of Better Leaders, Better Schools. Do you have any parting words of advice, and what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Best way to get a hold of me, if you can't find me, you're not trying hard enough. You know, you can find me at identitysecurity.com. A lot of my public speaking and strategy work I do is found at my professional site, Morgan Wright, MorganWright.us. Twitter at MorganWright_US. I'm easy to find on LinkedIn, and I do a lot of stuff on the media. So if you turn into one of the major cable news networks, usually I'm on Fox or Fox Business or Sirius XM. I do ones and zeros, no politics. That's the easiest way to find me. And the thing I'd leave you with is, look, you know, people, I realize they may have challenging times, but still, there's no other country I would want to have my problems in other than the United States of America. I've been to over 40 countries. I've worked in places where, last story here, and because it's so important to education. I told you I was senior advisor to the anti-terrorism assistance program in Pakistan. I've stayed good friends with one of the gentlemen I trained during that time. He was the deputy superintendent of police for the Islamabad Capital Territory Police. And I said, look, what's the one thing my question was, Sam, what's the one thing the United States could do for you? He says, free education. He says, right now, the only free education come from the madrasas, where there's a lot of radicalization and indoctrination in places like Pakistan and Kashmir, some of the territories. He says, education is so important. We want to provide good education here. And that's the parting thought I'd give you is, people don't, if you don't think education is important and what people view it, go to some of the places I've been. I know some of the places that you've worked with or seen other folks at. You'll realize the importance of education.
Well, Better Leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember that life is 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Daniel and Morgan. Be better starting today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type Morgan in the search bar, and the show notes page will pop up. You'll get the highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, and the best way to connect. Morgan, thanks again for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Better Leaders, thank you for joining us on the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Visit us at betterleadersbetterschools.com, a blog and podcast made specifically for you to help you meet your leadership potential. Have you gotten value from today's show? Help me reach even more listeners by leaving a 5-star rating and review. Click the podcast artwork and press the Show Some Love link to leave an honest rating and review. A long, long time ago in a galaxy far away, patrons would sponsor artists to create something the patron valued. Would you consider becoming a patron of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast? If you found this podcast valuable, if the show has pushed your thinking about leadership, and if you've benefited in any way, then I would be honored if you would become a sponsor. Sponsorship is easy. Head over to patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes to become a patron for as little as $1 a month. If you pledge $10 a month, I'll send you one of my favorite leadership books every other month. That's patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes. Do you have a question or need some leadership advice? I want to connect with you. I read every email, tweet, snap that's sent to me. Links are in the show notes to connect via email and social media. Better Leaders, Better Schools is a proud member of the Edu Podcast Network, podcast for educators, podcast by educators. You can listen to more great education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.